Hi, my name is Matthias Jochmann, and you are listening to Record of Change. Record of Change listens to 8 individuals located all over the globe about how their lives have been twisted by the COVID-19 pandemic. I am talking to you from Bonn in Germany, and today we will listen to Mike van Gaan, who is a well-established playwright and activist based in Cape Town, South Africa. In today's episode, Mike will share with us how the pandemic has struck the cultural scene in South Africa and how Mike felt more busy during than before the lockdown and how he and his colleagues are building up a foundation to make cultural practitioners more resilient.
My name is Mike van Gaan. I generally describe myself as a playwright at the moment, but I do work generally as a consultant as well. I'm based in Cape Town. For the last number of years, I've kind of been fortunate to be in a range of fellowships, my most recent one being at the University of Stellenbosch, called the Stellenbosch Institute for Advanced Study, where I was spending about 6 months to work on my first novel. And it was going to be for the period of 5 months, but then COVID struck and we went into lockdown at the end of March, and so that hasn't really happened. And for the last while, I've really just been exploring the playwriting and the consultancy mode.
Could you give us a brief sum up of how the pandemic struck maybe your environment or what you see in your environment?
Well, I suppose my environment comprises the broader South African context on the one hand, and then my engagement within the arts and in theatre in particular. And within the broader context of South Africa, I think what the pandemic kind of just emphasized was something that many of us have known for a long while, that since 1994, which is when the country shifted from being an apartheid state towards being a more democratic, more equitable country in terms of our constitutional vision anyway, the reality is that we've become a lot more unequal. So over the last 26 years, the gaps between those of us who are part of the middle class and the like, and those who are on the margins of society have just increased. And I think that what the pandemic has shown was just how great these inequalities are, because in terms of how we are supposed to prevent the coronavirus from spreading, you know, those of us with access to resources are much more able to buy sanitizers that have the requisite alcohol base. We are able to be socially distanced in that we live in places that are adequately spaced and the like, whereas most people in our country live in incredibly cramped conditions, in townships, in formal settlements and the like, and barely have money to pay for food and, you know, the very basics of life, let alone buy sanitizers and so on. So I think that there's always been the fear in our country that once COVID-19 kind of struck, that the elites that really brought the virus into the country by virtue of traveling globally would be spared, you know, the major effects in it. And ultimately, once it began to spread within the broader community, then there would be a pretty widespread and the death rate would be pretty high as well. But also because the level of comorbidities in our country is really high. 20% of our population, as you know, is infected with HIV. So immune systems are already kind of quite compromised. And the coronavirus, you know, is not kind to people with comorbidities, as we know. So I think that people were very complimentary to our government for the very strong stand that they took at the very beginning with a very hard lockdown, one of the hardest kind of lockdowns that people experience globally. We weren't even allowed to buy cigarettes and alcohol in that time, and everybody was confined to their houses. There was no room for exercise even outside of our houses. The only way we could go outside was for medical purposes or to get groceries. So we have these 5 levels of lockdown. And of course, what began to happen was that the longer the lockdowns were sustained, the more the other challenges within our society became more apparent. On the other hand, there've been some of the positive things, if you want to call it that, is that there's been a decrease in crime, in violent crime. And with the ban on the sale of alcohol, for example, car accidents kind of decreased, and there was a huge decrease in violent crime that's kind of linked to the consumption of alcohol. And when the lockdown was kind of eased at a certain point and alcohol sales were permitted, the level of violence that came about as a consequence of people now having access to alcohol again was such that the government immediately kind of clamped down and banned the sale of alcohol yet again, because it was placing strain on the hospital services, that the beds that were earmarked in ICU for COVID-19 people who kind of required it were now being consumed and used by people who were victims or perpetrators of violent crime linked to alcohol. So it's, again, a symptom of our society and the lack of attention that we've paid to addressing the inequalities of the past. And now, in a state of pandemic, as we're experiencing now, these inequalities come to be reflected in a whole range of social ways, and gender-based violence has increased as well. So basically, at a broader level as a country, we've experienced both the good and the bad of having a lockdown, but at the same time, it's kind of reflected mostly the bad in terms of the inequalities that are inherent in our society, the structural inequalities, and how difficult it is to be addressing these at the same time as having to deal with a pandemic that is basically one which is claiming literally hundreds of lives on a daily basis.
What is the current status in your environment?
In fact, we just went into lockdown level 2 days ago. So things are a little bit more relaxed. And if one went outside now, it's looking like it's normal, you know, restaurants are full and so on. But obviously, all these things still have to be done with the various kind of social distancing protocols. So everyone wears a mask. That's compulsory if one is outside. Social distancing rules still kind of prevail. So that government has had to weigh, as in other countries as well, on the one hand, economic decline and the consequences in terms of hunger and the adverse social impacts versus the kind of mortality prospects posed by COVID-19. And it's a very difficult position, you know, we'd concede the government to be in. And I think that that's what they're trying to balance at the moment. So we're not completely out of the woods yet. We're kind of hoping that as we move towards warmer times in our country, that these things will kind of dissipate. But in a way, we're still not at a position yet to declare that, you know, we are safe. We are still the country, I think, with the fifth highest number of infections globally. We don't have as high a mortality rate as other countries seem to have had. The percentage of deaths to infection is a lot lower than other countries, certainly much lower than the US, for example. But there's still a few hundred people dying on a daily basis due to COVID-19.
Thank you very much for this introduction to what happened so far. So you consider yourself a playwright?
So I mean, I am engaged within the art sector, and that's kind of been my primary focus for much of my adult life, yes. And the impact of COVID-19 this particular year has been such that four of my plays that were supposed to be done this year have all been impacted upon quite adversely. So one piece, a commission actually from the Fugard Theatre, which is one of our country's primary theatres and a very active theatre, they commissioned me to do a play to coincide and be part of a season of plays that celebrated their 10th anniversary this year. Another play was kind of been done by an independent company, and that had in fact started at the Market Theatre and was a week into its 3-week run, and all of those have basically been stopped. So the Fugard Theatre has in fact shut down, and this is a pretty major blow to the theatre industry in our country. It's, as I said, probably besides the Baxter Theatre in Cape Town, it was the most active theatre in our city. And basically, they've decided not to reopen until a vaccine has been found. So at the moment, theatres are theoretically open. They can have up to 50 people within the audience. But most theatres, in fact, I think all theatres have remained shut because they cannot guarantee the safety either of their workers or of people on their stages and, of course, certainly not of the audience. So I think it's going to be a while before theatres reopen. And as a consequence, a lot of people, as in other parts of the world, have lost income. They certainly don't have any streams of income for the next while. And although government has kind of made available a significant package of relief for small businesses and the like, the arts have not really been a beneficiary of that relief. And even when money has been made available within the arts sector for relief, the definitions of artists as not being employees but independent contractors again makes them ineligible to access that. So it's been a real problem for the arts sector, and I think it's again highlighted some of the challenges around labor legislation as it pertains to the social sectors generally, and in particular how it impacts on the arts sector, because so many of us are independent contractors rather than employees.
How are theaters subsidized? I mean, coming from Germany, maybe theater-wise, from one of the most privileged countries where government spends a lot of money, and now they've also been spending good sums of money to people that have loss of income, of course, due to the pandemic. How does it work in South Africa?
So South Africa probably has, on the African continent, the most well-subsidized arts and culture sector. And it is significantly more subsidized by public funding than was the case even under apartheid. So when those of us were engaged in arts and culture kind of policy advocacy as the country was changing, we did not expect that our government would at that time make more resources available for the arts, given the other major legacies of apartheid that our society had to deal with. So in a sense, the only money that we had available for the arts then was the money that had been allocated by the apartheid government for the white minority. And policy then really revolved around how to use money that had been made available by the state to serve 8 million white people to now serve 40 million citizens. And what has happened over the course of the last 26 years is that government has become increasingly neoliberal in its orientation, in that they've looked to the market to provide the support for the arts and culture sector. And our government is bought into the whole notion of creative industries, which is something which comes from UNESCO and the European Commission and basically Global North, you know, kind of places where the creative industries have been able to survive because the conditions there are conducive towards it. You've got people who are educated, you've got infrastructure, you've got people with disposable income. Whereas on our continent, those conditions just do not prevail. So to talk about creative industries, which require markets with disposable income and the like, means that you basically are making the arts available to people who are part of the elite. So it's a long answer to your question. But essentially what government does is it provides money for the infrastructure and for the people who run that infrastructure, but not money for anything to happen on the stages. So you've got significant amounts of money allocated to infrastructure, but very little money allocated to the actual production and distribution of theatre. And that's what the challenge is in our country. So a lot of us are kind of involved right now in trying to change those policies again, to come to a point where, you know, we revisit policymaking and see money as being much more necessary to fund theatre makers and dance companies and dance and theatre companies than to be funding infrastructure, which is just, you know, monuments to what governments prefer. They prefer infrastructure because for some of them, that means a whole lot more than funding that which is produced and taken to where people are. I mean, so many of these buildings are located in places that are inaccessible, and that given our very poor transport systems, people don't access them at night. And this is partly why policy needs to change and shift the allocation of funding towards where theatre is really being created and distributed at the moment.
You see me a bit overwhelmed now with so much new information because I honestly didn't have much of an idea. So I read in one of your texts that you would like to take this current weird time to rethink culture and how can culture and the arts be more self-reliant?
So what happened with my experience of my own kind of productions being curtailed was that although they weren't my productions, they were my plays, but other people were kind of responsible for them financially. But I have, by virtue of being around a lot longer than these young companies, I've got a network of people who've come to see my plays in the past, and a network of what I've kind of called angels who support my work. So I, for a while, have made a decision not to go to the public sector to look for funding, and not to go to the traditional ways of, but to go to individuals to support my work. So individual patrons and the like. So I basically, you know, said to the actors and the technical crew of these plays that had now been cancelled, that I will seek to raise money from my network. And when they required money to pay their rent or to cover their data costs for their mobile phone or to pay for food, they should let me know and I will make money available to them. And so I kind of went to my database and said, look, in lieu of theatre basically shutting down for the next few months, and at that time, I didn't expect anything to open up until at least September. And at that time, people were saying, no, don't worry, it'll be a few weeks and then we'll be open. And I kind of said, look, give us sufficient resources for us to be able to take people through at least 4 months of support. And through that, I was able to pay for actors to be able to pay their rent and to pay for food. I mean, as basic as food, you know, people were really struggling to pay for food and the like. And so I kind of thought, well, maybe here's a model that we can use to make it even bigger on a more kind of global scale for theatre and dance in our country. Because what COVID-19 also reflected was that theatre and dance in particular were going to be quite adversely affected by the lockdown restrictions. Many other art forms people were able to distribute and consume digitally. So, you know, you can buy a book and read it on Kindle, you can see movies on Netflix and so on. And although many people kind of took their shows onto online platforms, A, they didn't know how to monetize it, and B, the production values were so poor that if people had access to Netflix, why would they watch a piece of theater online? And thirdly, as you know, so much of what happens in theater and dance is about the direct encounter. And so you kind of had these poor examples of stand-up comics, for example, taking their work online, but performing in a studio without any audience and really struggling because there was no one. So I and a few friends within the sector, we've kind of got together to form a private foundation to support theatre and dance. And we're calling it Sustaining Theatre and Dance. And the acronym is STAND, STAND Foundation. And so we've come up with a whole range of projects that we will seek to support. And using the hashtag like still standing, or, you know, we've come up with a whole range of things. And what we've essentially done as startup funding for it is we've gone to individuals within the sector who have made it as practitioners, stand-up comic or a really famous actor or director or whatever, and said to them, can you donate 10,000 Rand? You can work it out what it's like in euros. It's probably about maybe 500 euros or so, which in euros terms is not much, but, you know, in our context, 10,000 Rand is not insignificant. And so we wanted to get about 50 patrons who would make this amount of money available by our launch. And then we would have that body of money to be able to initiate a whole bunch of things. We were also kind of raising money from, you know, embassies and companies and the like. So the idea is that we would build up eventually a database of 100,000 people in our country who support theatre and dance. And we would ask them to provide a monthly contribution of 100 Rand, which is, you know, maybe 5 euros a month. And so this is kind of working on scale. So if you had 100,000 people, it would be 500,000 euros a month, which we would then be able to use to support the sector. And that's basically what our vision is. And that's what we are now working towards. And we took a decision that we will not make money available in an artist relief kind of way to make money available to pay for people's rent and the like. We wanted to have projects through which artists could earn money. So it will be their dignity kind of being affirmed, And they would then be able to cover their costs in that way, because also artists want to work. They want to be rehearsing. They want to be producing. Yeah, that's, you know, that's what they want. So essentially what we're saying is folk within the dance and theater sector, if the last 26 years have shown anything, is that we're on our own. Forget about government coming to the party. We need to look to ourselves to find ways to support ourselves.
That's amazing. I mean, since pandemic appeared, I read so many articles and so many people were talking about solidarity, but in my, let's say in my bubbles that I act in or get my news from, I would say this discourse on solidarity pretty soon disappeared, and unfortunately. So I'm very happy to hear such a great initiative.
Yeah. Look, I mean, you know, let's talk again in 3 months' time and see where we are. And, you know, if we can get into the cycle where we are, we, you know, the whole notion of solidarity is, and the whole notion of the COVID-19 pandemic is that people say we are only safe when we are all safe. And that is true of the pandemic, but it's also true of a country like ours that faces the kind of inequalities that we do, that the elites are only safe when everybody in our country feels they've got a stake in our society. If people are on the underside of history, those who are in the elite parts of our society are always going to feel threatened, because at some stage, social unrest, crime, and so on will affect them. And so I think the notion of solidarity is one in which we kind of see that even if we do not buy into the moral principle that equality is a good thing and the right thing, then at least seek it for your own strategic interests, that it's in your best interests to be in solidarity and to act in solidarity with others. And that's kind of, you know, in a way what we're trying to promote.
It sounds like you're super busy with this. And I was wondering, because I read that you were writing a novel, actually.
So actually, I've been involved in a number of different things there. So yes, I mean, I started writing a novel because, so last year I was an artist in residence at the University of Pretoria, and my commission there was to write a play about the Sustainable Development Goals. And it was really successful. In fact, it's now been prescribed as a text to be studied by schools. But they kind of then invited me and said, look, we'd like you to come back to the university and come and teach. But for that, you need a PhD. And I mean, I'd never seen myself in academia, always avoided it because it's not part of reality for me. I'd much more prefer to be kind of engaged in what was happening. But I said, okay, let's look at it. I'm getting older, so maybe this is not a bad thing. And I see my role now as kind of being much more building a new tier of leadership in a way. And maybe the university was the place in which to do that. So I'd had this fellowship lined up to do this novel, told them about it. They said, well, make it part of the PhD, write a novel and do the PhD in creative writing. And voila, we'll all be happy. So that's kind of how it came about. But I'm telling you this, Matthias, I mean, the COVID times and the lockdown period, one would think it's kind of being conducive to creativity because you have time, but I just haven't found that to be the case at all. That's really not been an appropriate time to sit down and particularly try to write a novel. You know, it should be my first time and I'd need to give it more thought than writing a play.
So if I got you right, you couldn't use the time in lockdown because you didn't have time, is that right?
Well, this has been one of the ironies of lockdown, that one thought one had more time, but what has also happened is that Zoom has kind of taken over our lives. One thing ends on Zoom, the next thing starts 50 minutes later. So in fact, our lives have kind of sped up, which is like really bizarre. I mean, the irony is, in terms of plays, I haven't really thought I would spend time writing plays because where's the outlet? And in terms of the country, probably one of the two most productive theaters in terms of new work. They commissioned me to write a play together with five younger writers, all of us writing the same play. And their commission was to write a play of these times, but not about these times. So in other words, we weren't required to write a play about COVID-19 or even to mention COVID-19, but to look at what is the zeitgeist of this particular moment. And most of the writers are kind of 30 and under. And so I'm kind of serving as a so-called head writer to synthesize all these different things. So we've been meeting every Monday, you know, for 2 hours on different writing exercises and seeing kind of what emerges. And it's been fascinating because we're now kind of at the end of that particular process. But even for these younger folk, it's the theme of mortality is the one that has come up in all of their writing. They're 22 years old, 24 years old, 28 years old, but having to confront mortality is the thing that for most of their writing, yeah, is a thing. So that's actually been very interesting to see how the pandemic, in terms of people's writing of these times, but not about these times, is kind of impacting. And then we sit on the stand committee. As I said, there are 10 of us. And at the beginning of each meeting, we kind of have a little bit of a check-in just to see where each of us is because of these particular times. And I tell you, Matthias, it's been incredible. Every single week for the last 6 weeks, one of us has known someone who's died, you know, every single week. If it's not someone, I mean, one guy had his cousin pass away 2 weeks ago and then his uncle the week after that. The chairperson of our committee had the CEO of their company, her mother died 2 weeks ago. So, you know, it's a real sense in a very confrontational way for many people in our country at the moment that they are dealing with anxiety of their mortality, you know, that everybody knows people very close to them who have either died or are in the process of dying or whatever. And I think that this is also affecting people's mental wellness, you know. So the financial crisis that people are experiencing and the impact that that has on people's ability to look after their families, to care for, to take care of themselves and those that they feel responsible for is causing increasing emotional and psychological anxiety.
I just got goosebumps. I would try to shift it to a bit lighter topic.
Ooh, again. That would be nice.
I mean, in the beginning, you said that actually, or most probably, the virus was brought in by people who travel a lot. And as far as I know, you've also been traveling a lot. So I'm wondering, would you already see some consequences that you take personally?
Yeah, so certainly. I mean, and that's going to be the case kind of globally, that it's those of us who've been able to travel that have, you know, basically caused the virus to jump, as it were, across continents. So one has certainly become aware of that. And I think that also, you know, what this time has kind of shown is the potential challenges that we are going to be facing as a result of climate change. So in a way, this is like a foretaste of that. But I think that what these times have shown is that we can all be a little bit more reflective about how we have done things in the past and how we can shift to doing things in the future. And I certainly don't see the need for myself to be traveling as much as I did, you know, and in fact, the last 5 months of being in one place have actually been really cool. I mean, I don't think for the last, 20 years, I've spent that amount of time in one place in that country, and it's not been a bad experience at all, you know. So I suppose it's about now trying to understand these new conditions, well, the old conditions in terms of inequity, but within the context of potential climate change and its impact, how do we deliver on human solidarity and all of us having better lives globally than has been the case till now. And I suppose, Matthias, my final thing on this is that I've also always said that our country in a way is a microcosm for the world, you know. We've inherited from an apartheid past a white minority that is resourced, that has privilege, and a black majority upon whom the white minority has really built its current wealth and privilege. In the same way as colonialism has empowered a largely white minority of countries at the expense of, you know, the people of color kind of countries. And although one is wanting to make changes where one is because you want the world to be a better place, you kind of also confront the kind of really deep structural inequalities and how do you change those structures, you know? And how do you change people who are in charge of structures, who are so invested in keeping those structures as they are, out of self-interest? So it really has been a time also for that kind of reflection, because in the previous dispensation when you've just kind of been engaged. Every day there's something that you need to be engaged in. You're always thinking that it's contributing somehow to a better world. It doesn't allow you much time to reflect. Is this really contributing to a better world? And I think that what this time has done is allowed one to maybe think a little bit more about these things and what really should one be doing and how should one be doing it in order to bring about the more just, the more equitable world that we all kind of like to think we believe in.
I would say these were wonderful last words. Thank you very much.
This was episode 5 with Mike van Gaan. Stay tuned for the following episode of Record of Change, when we will hear Alan, who is a queer man based in Bangalore, India. He will share with us how the lockdown forced him to stay indoors with his pets, but separated from his partner. Follow Record of Change on your favorite podcast provider and find out more about the stories behind on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, or our website, recordofchange.com. This podcast is implemented with and by members of the Bosch Alumni Network, a community that brings together former and current fellows, grantees, and staff members of the Robert Bosch Stiftung and its partners.